Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Miles Podcast. This is episode 6, and I have the privilege of having Dr. Bill Petock, who is a licensed psychologist and has been working with men and infertility for many, many years, pretty much since the beginning, probably. And we have him on here just to have some of his wisdom and to also talk about SART as well, which is the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology, and have some questions regarding that association too. So welcome, Bill.
Stephen, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real privilege to be here.
So one of the questions I'm interested in is, how did you get into reproductive mental health?
It's a great question, and let me start by saying I'm an outlier in that many of my colleagues who are in the field were first introduced to it through their own experience with reproductive challenges. I got introduced to it by my brother-in-law, who's a reproductive endocrinologist. And if you'll bear with me, I'll tell you the story.
Mm-hmm.
He was post-residency, which he did at the University of Michigan in OB-GYN, came to Baltimore, where I live, and ran a residency program at a local hospital 3 blocks from my home. And he invited me to come over and teach the residents about human sexuality, something which they do not learn very much of in medical school. So I started working with residents there, and he introduced me to a little bit of reproductive medicine because he knew he was going to do a fellowship at Hopkins shortly after a couple of years. So he moved down to Hopkins and called me up one day and he said, "I am learning an awful lot about getting people pregnant, but I do not understand the psychological issues involved with infertility. Would you be willing to see some people for me?" He knew I had a postdoc in family therapy.
Okay.
He also knew that I was, you know, teaching his former residents human sexuality, and that there's an interface between those two things, infertility and sex.
Right.
So I said to him, "I'll be willing to do that. It's a family crisis, and I know something about families. You teach me the medical part." So that was 1985, and I started working with some of his patients and continued to do so since then. 1990, I went to my first American Society for Reproductive Medicine meeting. At the time, it was the Psychological Special Interest Group, and took a two-day course in doing mental health interventions with fertility patients, and pretty much have kept going since then.
So when you first joined that group, right?
Yeah.
How many men were in there?
There had been a former chair, I think the second or third chair of MHPG was a man. And I think the first few years, there might have been one or two other guys. I was going for the post-grad courses. You could get continuing ed, learn an awful lot from really smart people. And that I didn't start going to the annual meeting until about 96, when somebody said, "How come you're not sticking around for the scientific meeting?" I had small kids. I was going on the weekends.
Yeah.
There were challenges as you're
well. Yeah, for sure.
So there were very few men. And to this day, there continue to be very few men, as you're well aware. We have about 650 members in North America for the mental health professional group, and less than 3% are men.
Yeah.
And way less than that show up at the annual meetings, you being one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's just, to highlight, and I've talked to other people about it too. It's like, I could probably count on one hand, maybe six, maybe, because, there are some people that are doing it that are not part of ASRM.
Right.
But there's still, it's less than, at least two hands worth,
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting because there are male members who are physicians. For example, my brother-in-law, Bill Schlaff, has always been an MHPG member, didn't go to the meetings, but he always felt it was important to support mental health from the reproductive endocrine side of things. So he was a male member, but not an active one.
Me, I feel like that is, it's something more common now, but I wonder how common it was back then to really kind of put two and two together that there's a medical piece to this, but then there's also a psychological piece, and him having basically the vulnerability to say, I don't understand this piece, but it makes an impact on their quality of life and their lives.
Well, I think, you know, there are several factors operating there. He's a smart guy to start with.
Yeah.
But you know, I had been married to his sister. He knew I was a psychologist. We had had conversations about mental health issues related to OBGYN. And so it wasn't a big leap for him. And, you know, the notion that psychosocial factors are important probably goes back to the 70s with the beginning of Resolve and the notion of support groups, you know, it primarily focused on women, even to this day, although there's a significant acknowledgement of the incidence of male factor infertility.
Yeah, absolutely. So it basically started in 85 to kind of work with couples. What have been some of the common themes that you've seen from men kind of throughout the years? And also, has there been different common themes like throughout different generations?
Well, I think there are common themes that run throughout the course of my professional career with regard to men. I think the most common one is this is a huge shock. You know, there's a significant discrepancy in the way men and women learn about sexual health, reproductive health. Young men typically do not get very much education in that regard, and young women do.
Mm-hmm.
Menstruation being a marker for women learning about reproductive health, there is nothing comparable that happens to a man. You know, at best, a man realizes that when he touches himself in a certain way, it feels good, and he does that. Women, of course, learn that when you reach a certain age, it's important to take care of menstruation and things like that. It's a very different messages.
Absolutely.
And the messaging to men typically is don't get someone pregnant and don't get a disease. And it isn't, there are factors which are important to maintain your reproductive health. So that's sort of missing. So when a guy encounters a problem with fertility that is male factor, it may be a huge surprise to him because he may be having regular ejaculations, which is not a problem. And so his knowledge typically is, I produce sperm, sperm creates babies. Why am I not producing a baby? I'm producing sperm.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a real kick in the gut and can have an impact on both psychological issues, you know, how you feel about yourself, that there's something that is not whole, as well as an impact on sexual function. Because, you know, sex, which was about love and at some point producing children, is now about failure.
Yeah.
And that plays a very heavy role. I think the other thing that's been consistent over time is not having a strong model for talking about this. You know, talk about reproductive health. Their physicians typically don't ask them about reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
Women are, if they're getting good medical care, are seeing somebody yearly for an OBGYN physical. And guys don't do that. The first time a guy goes to a urologist is when he's got a problem.
Yeah.
And women are doing it for good health. So there's that disconnect. And guys typically don't talk about whether or not they're trying to have children. That is not typical office talk with guys. Women may be a different story. So lack of opportunity, lack of experience, shame and stigma associated with this conflation of sex and fertility. You know, if you are not fertile, you must be sexually a failure, is the underlying message that many men receive, not from their professional providers, but from the culture at large.
Right. And I think also partly, it's also been historically, the narrative has been that fertility has always been a woman's issue.
Right.
You know, and I think that's, I mean, a lot of men that I've interviewed on here was, no one really realized that male infertility was a thing. You know, like it was something that like that could happen. And that in itself, you know, you think about masculinity and how that ties to virility and fertility and all of that, and how that impacts them, because you have this sense of, I'm a man, like I just produce sperm, and like you said, like it just was supposed to happen. Correct. And then when it doesn't, it's like makes you question a lot of things.
Yes, absolutely. I guess, you know, the other thing that, you know, you asked about trends over time. And when I started in the field, the possibilities for retrieving sperm were very limited. You know, there's multiple kinds of male factor infertility, but one of them is obstructive azoospermia. So there's no way for the sperm to get from the testicles out. And today, there are surgical procedures which hadn't been invented when I started. There are microsurgical procedures which can go in and extract sperm from the epididymis. And actually, there are now microsurgical procedures which can extract sperm directly from the testicle. So those didn't exist in the beginning, and now they do. And so guys are offered more opportunities for retrieving sperm and achieving a pregnancy. However, you know, just retrieving the fact that you can retrieve a single sperm from a testis predicated on there being some way of getting that single sperm into an egg. And so the advent of something called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, was a significant advantage that didn't exist when I started in the field. So right. It was possible under a microscope for one egg to be held on a pipette and one sperm to be inserted into a very, very thin pipette and put directly into that egg. And that didn't exist in the beginning. So there are additional tools. Now, having said that, something which has always been there from my beginning in the field is the use of a donor. And that is, and has been, continues to be a significant challenge for many men. The notion that my sperm is not impregnating my wife, my partner. That's problematic. And a lot of it depends on how we talk about this. And so there are many, many, this is a very deep, you know, concept, which is probably, you know, that's another podcast just on donor sperm.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's been around since 1884. But our knowledge of evaluating donors, selecting donors, and how to talk with children about donor conception has evolved dramatically since 1884. In 1884, the donor recipient, the wife, was never told that she was inseminated with the donor. She was anesthetized and inseminated. Something called what we would call today IUI, intrauterine insemination. Yeah. Probably wasn't intrauterine in those days because they didn't have the catheters to get it through the cervix. However, today, we're far more knowledgeable about what happens to children when they find out that they were donor conceived. And as you're well aware, our knowledge suggests that talking early about this and utilizing terminology which normalizes it and is consistent with the child's age developmentally is the most useful thing, rather than hiding.
Yeah. The episode that is released today, so today being February 3rd, there's a guy with Klinefelter's. And it's always been interesting because the previous guys I've had on here that have had azoospermia, the thought of using sperm donation when they was introduced was like, there's no way I'm doing that. We're going to try all these things. Right. And then when faced with the reality of this is your only choice, then they were a little bit more open. But it was refreshing with this, like with this guy, because he was like, I think, I want to say their chances for IVF were lower, and it didn't really pay for them to do it. And the doctor didn't recommend doing IVF.
Yeah.
So he was already faced with a choice, and he's like, I want children. This is where we're going to do. Were there some things? Yeah. Like there were things you worried about, you know, considering about like attachment, am I going to be attached to my kids when they're born? And, right. And then you think about resemblance and if they're going to look like me and all that stuff. And
yeah,
for listeners, I would recommend going back and listening to it because this will probably be out in another week. But yeah, it was kind of a refreshing take on it. You know, like it's very light and kind of easy going.
I think some men are able to look at it and say, okay, I'm going to love this child no matter what. I'm going to raise this child. And I'm sure you do this. I do this all the time. But talk about what is parenting. Parenting is, in my view, what happens after the baby arrives and continues on for at least the next 25 years or till they get their own cell phone plan, as I'm fond of saying. And, you know, it's an ongoing process. I mean, my son is 41. My daughter is 38. I'm still parenting in some ways, not nearly as intensely as I was before. But there's, you know, that goes on ongoing.
Yeah.
I think there's a leap. There's no question there's a leap from saying this is my genetic connection to this is my connection. And the genes aren't there. I'm going to love this kid no matter what. Because I want to be a parent. And this is my best alternative. Now, I'll give you another interesting example I just had a couple of weeks ago. I was working with a case, and the couple came to me for a consultation about using donor sperm. He was azoospermic, or maybe had a genetic issue that really had an impact on fertility.
Yeah.
I can't remember the details. They're not important.
Yeah.
So we set up a consultation to talk about what are the things that are important to consider when you're using a donor. And before the consultation took place, they called and said, we changed our plan. We're going to use donor embryos. I said, okay. So, you know, we have the session. We start talking about it. I asked them, why did you make the decision to change? And he said, we thought about it and we concluded that we wanted to be equal in our genetic connection to our child. So the only way to do that was for neither of us to have a genetic connection. And both of us, and he said, we're going to love the child no matter what. It raises other issues. It raises other challenges. But I thought it was a, you know, very balanced way of thinking about their problem. It was their solution.
Right.
I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think there's one right or wrong way to go about becoming a parent. There are literally tens of thousands, if not millions, of families who have adopted children, who have fostered children, where there's no genetic connection. And if you talk to those kids, I have a colleague from graduate school who was adopted. Her parents were the people who raised her.
Yeah.
Yes, there were people who birthed her, but her parents were the people who raised her.
See, it's interesting with adoption because doing social work, like adoption was something my wife and I were going down that path.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardest thing was, is that my relationship or my thoughts of adoption were all solely based off of my social work. The job that I'm working with kids and children. And usually if I'm seeing them, it's not a good scenario.
Correct.
You know what I mean? There's this idea that adoption, you just see the negative side of it, you know, and you don't get to see the positive, even though I know there's several people that have been adopted. My former supervisor was one of the person that trained me when I first ended up in my position, within the agency. There are several people that have been successfully out there doing jobs and stuff. And it's sometimes hard as a social worker to have that. You get that narrow view, you know.
I think you're right. You know, I mean, why do people come to see us? Because they're having some kind of a problem. And so you get a skewed view of the world. I'm fond of, I'm married to an attorney who's retired. And, you know, I kid her about the fact that the only reason you go see an attorney is because you're worried about something going wrong. Nobody goes to see an attorney because something's going right. Same thing with an accountant. But, you know, your experience is consistent with mine. I have a dear friend from college who was adopted, and he didn't find out about his birth family till he was in his early 60s. Not because anybody was keeping it from him, but because it was just hard to track down.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, look, there are many ways to create families. You know, people who are seeing us want to have families, and that's our big job, is helping them with the psychological, psychosocial, educational piece of it. What you and I do is help people make informed decisions.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because yesterday I was at work and we had like our retreat. So it was like the day that we do like some trainings and fun stuff and and everything. And I was talking to a coworker that was, she's 37 or something like that. And, you know, people know what I like, my podcast and like all the advocacy and stuff I do. And like, we just got to talking and stuff. And she's like, you know, like, I want to have kids, but then people ask me if I do it, I don't, you know, like. And she was worried because she's like, you know, like, I have all this anxiety, like, and I feel like I need to be like psychologically prepared and stuff. And I was like, told her, like, there's so much research out there that says that stress does not cause infertility.
Yeah.
You know, and she was like, really? And I'm like, yeah, like, your anxiety is not going to cause you to have infertility. You know, because she was talking about like, you know, cortisol, like, and how that impacts and stress and everything. And I'm like, yeah, but like, I said that there's been a ton of research out there, you know, and I just remember Angela Lawson had posted on LinkedIn, and it was an article that was talking about like stress and stuff. And she was commented about like how many women come in just crying because like they're blaming themselves because they feel like they're so stressed and it's causing, you know, like, and it's such a misconception.
Well, you're right. And it's an old one. I, you know, I got friends who are, you know, who have dealt with fertility issues because I'm old enough to know a lot of people have done it. So a good buddy of mine from high school and college, he and his wife had significant problems. I mean, she had 8 miscarriages, 2 of them were ectopic pregnancies. I mean, just a brutal history.
Yeah.
He's a mental health professional, and they were meeting with somebody, and, you know, this was back in the early 80s, and somebody said to him, you know, well, when she just relaxes, everything will happen, or when she's ready to, you know, the notion of psychogenic infertility was still alive, and that's just not right. Doesn't work like that. They have 2 wonderful kids who are the result of a traditional surrogacy.
Okay.
His sperm, the carrier's egg, and uterus. It happens much, much less today.
Yeah.
But back in the 80s, that's what it was. And they had to go adopt the kids because parentage was with the person whose egg it was. And the law hadn't evolved. It's obviously, as you talked about, this is a very complicated situation that involves law, medicine, psychology, mental health, all of that.
Yeah. And it's interesting how like those things, those anecdotes still get passed like through generations. Because like, how many times have couples been saying like, oh, you just need to relax?
Oh.
Do you know what it means?
It's
been refuted like that. That's not the case. But yet people still.
Of course. And, you know, the challenge for those of us who do what we do is recognizing that the average person is not reading the mental health literature.
Right.
They're reading popular accounts of, or people give good advice, well-intentioned advice, which isn't good because they don't know the science behind it. And there's no reason why they should know the science behind it, because we don't do a good job of teaching reproductive health to our young people so they understand it. But that's another story for another day.
That is exactly what I'm trying to change.
Well, that's clearly what this series is about, and I respect that a lot.
I mean, I think about all the different careers, right? I mean, all the different career paths like that are involved in like IVF, IUI. I mean, even just adoption and foster care. I mean, just the whole gamut, right?
Yep.
Like you have biology, you have law, you have, you know, psychology, social work, counseling, you know, you have medical, nursing, you know, like there's so many different avenues to be involved in this, but yet in our education, we don't talk about like infertility and the prevalence of it. I mean, it's somebody's likely going to know somebody, you know.
No, without a doubt. If unless you're living in a cave, you're going to know somebody who struggled with conception.
Yeah.
They may or may not have talked with you about it.
Yeah.
But certainly some cases will be obvious.
Yeah.
You know, you when we started, you said you wanted to ask some questions about Sartre. And
yeah, absolutely. And
let me direct you to that, okay?
Okay.
I think it's a set of data which is available to both professionals as well as people who are potentially patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so SART, the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, represents about 85% of the infertility clinics in the United States. It is a United States-based
yep.
organization. There are similar organizations elsewhere, so it started in the 80s, and it grew up because the reproductive technology centers recognized that quality was important. Success rates were important.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before Congress decided the same thing was true. So the Fertility Clinic Success Rate and Certification Act of 1992, sometimes referred to as the Wyden Act, named after its sponsor, mandates that clinics performing assisted reproductive technology annually provide data for all procedures performed to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it sets forth definitions and reporting requirements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So SART came around and said, you know, we're the providers, and we have a good understanding of what the procedures are. Would the CDC like us to collect that data? And for a long time, CDC data came direct from SART.
Okay.
So what happens every year is clinics report IVF cycles and outcomes. The data is validated, and it takes about 2 years to get validated data, because if you do a cycle today, you may not transfer the embryo till the end of the year, and the baby won't be born till 2 years away through the next year. So you don't have validated data for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But anybody can go to SART.org, SART.org, and look at national data, and then look at clinic-specific data. And what SART has done, which is different from what CDC has done, is done a very fine grain analysis. So if you are a woman who is 34 and has endometriosis and is using your own egg and has a BMI of 32, you can find out what your success rate probability is on a national level and for the clinic that you're looking at. Now, the national data is probably better because it's an aggregate of everything, and your clinic only treated two women with that particular diagnosis. It also shows male factor data as well. Not as strongly as the female factor data, because it's harder to collect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that data is there, broken out by clinic or by the national level. So I use it with patients who come in, and, you know, one of our jobs is to help people have realistic expectations.
Yeah.
You know that not every cycle is successful, not every transfer is successful. What's the likelihood that you'll be successful if you are 39, using a donor, and have some kind of uterine problem? You know, you've got fibroids or something. So that information is available. And your doctor can walk you through that data. If the clinic doesn't report to SART or CDC, that's a problem, because the law requires it. And there are some clinics who, a small number, last time I looked, there were about 40 in the U.S. that didn't report to either. And, you know, SART, you got to have a certain number of cases per year for the data to be meaningful. So SART says, unless you have X number of cases a year, don't report to us.
Yeah.
I think 20 is the cutoff.
Okay.
So some clinics may not report because the number is just too small, but they're required to report to the CDC. That's the law.
Okay.
That's an important piece. And the other thing that SART does is it takes a look at the data for your clinic, and it says there are certain factors which are important, and if your success rate is lower than the national norm by a specific factor, which is determined every year, we want to give you help so you can get better. So yeah. There are a number of things that are looked at. Number one is, how many embryos are transferred? We know that a single embryo transfer is better for the mother and better for the baby, yep. simply because it's less stress on both of them physically. So in the old days, people would transfer multiple embryos because the success rates are so low, and they didn't have the testing available to look at embryos for their quality. But you wound up with nightmares like the Octomom story.
Yeah.
Multiple embryos were transferred. 8 babies were born. They were all extremely low birth weight. They spent an extensive amount of time in the NICU. And it was very, very stressful on those babies and on the mother. And the doctor made a mistake. Today, if SART sees an outlier, somebody who's got an excessive numbers of multiple embryo transfers and multiple births being the critical variable, SART says, hey, let us give you some help so you can get better at single embryo transfers and improve. So that's another way that SART works with clinics to improve those qualities. The other thing that SART does is it checks for certifications for things like the lab. The lab must be certified. That's part of the Y. So if the lab director and the laboratory itself are not certified by one of the two certifying organizations, that's a problem, because the lab, as you're well aware, is critical for outcomes.
Yeah.
Doctors retrieve eggs, doctors retrieve sperm. Lab people put those two things together, and lab people incubate those embryos so that they're available for transfer by doctors. So that's a critical step. So SART monitors that. In fact, there are two representatives on the SART board that deal with the organizations that certify laboratories. So there's a lot of collaboration there.
Yeah, and there was a recent research article on lab differences. And I don't remember if it was like genetic testing or, I can't remember. But I remember that there was lab differences in, I can't remember what it was, but it was in the recent journal article.
Those kinds of articles get published on a regular basis. And the other thing about SART is because there's such a large collection of data, it's possible for researchers to get data sets and take a look at issues that are very important.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're using certain culture medium for embryos, does that do better than another culture medium? And how much oxygen should be present in the culture medium to get optimal growth? Is it better to do a day 3 or day 5 transfer? What's the difference between using fresh and frozen embryos in terms of outcomes?
Right.
But for your listeners, those frozen embryos are thawed before they're transferred. And so there's a lot of retrospective research which is done to look at other factors which will be important going forward in the future and help clinics make changes in process so they get better outcomes. So SART serves a sort of a monitoring function. It serves a quality control and improvement function, and it serves a research function. In addition, it's an opportunity for really smart people to get together and exchange ideas.
Yeah. So this is a question that I had on the list that I gave you, mm-hmm. because I remember being at ASR in Baltimore and we were at dinner.
Yep.
And I was talking about how some couples and individuals were taking SART data and using that to choose whatever clinic. Mm-hmm. And I remember you saying like that was not the intention, which you kind of gave what the intention and what SART really, you know, was really about. Yep. But I just wonder what your thoughts are on that, because I just know from different groups, right? Facebook groups and everything, like people are talking about SART and, this clinic has a better success rate than this one. But I mean, there's other variables that go into that as well, obviously.
So the intention was not so you could compare clinic A and B and say they're better. The intention was, well, first of all, it has become compliance with the law.
Yeah.
Secondly, it was to provide quality control and quality assurance and quality improvement. Mm-hmm. Now, will people look at the data and say, well, clinic A has a better success rate overall than clinic B? Yeah, that might be one thing you do, but there are so many factors that go into it. You'd almost have to say, how does clinic A do with people who are most like me and have the same conditions that I do versus clinic B? And even then, you know data, you've studied statistics. There's only one statistic which is important, and that's you. And so if 37% of people get pregnant and you don't, all that matters is that you didn't. And if 47% of people don't get pregnant and you do, all that matters is that you do. So making comparisons is difficult in the best of worlds.
Yeah.
It's more about, I think, all right, I'm 42 and I want to use my own egg. What's the likelihood that I'm going to get pregnant? Less than 3%. So do I want to do something to improve my chances of having a child? And that data is where it's most useful for a conversation between patient and doctor about what makes the most sense.
Yeah.
How can you improve your probability of success? Not is this clinic better than that clinic? Because 1 year, clinic A might do great with 37-year-olds with endometriosis, and clinic B might do great with patients with prior myomectomy surgery, and then the next year it flips. I don't think that means, oh, we're going to go work with this clinic this year and next year because we got this condition, we're going to go down the street to the next clinic. Patients, I'm sure, have said to you, what is really important to me is how I am treated, the kind of relationship I develop with mm-hmm. both my physician and the staff, as well as their ability to do a good job.
Yeah.
If you're treated poorly and the outcomes are great, what's the likelihood you're going to keep going back? If your outcome's not good, I think it's lower. And there's data that would support that.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what I was going to say is that it's not just about the success rates, and the other factors. It's really about the relationship, like if the clinic is serving you well. Because like with my story, we went to three different clinics.
Yeah.
One of them was like, wanted to do the surgery, going to be $5,000. We were young, didn't have that kind of money, got a second opinion, went to a different clinic. Mm-hmm. Insurance change, and then we went back to the original clinic, and then basically gave us a 15% chance. And my wife devastated when like, but that's not good enough. So we went and tried a different one, and we, the doctor called us in the evening, and consulted, and it was a world of a difference. We had one doctor, whereas some of the clinics was multiple doctors, which is okay for some people, but for us, we wanted that one person to be able to connect with and understand our story.
And I think that's, that's one of the important messages is it's about you, the patient, and what works best for you, assuming people are properly trained and clinics and labs are properly mm-hmm. certified. Do they meet the high level standard of care? Then it's going to be some other factors. Some clinics are really good at staying in touch with patients during that 2-week wait after the transfer before the test. Some clinics are not as good at that. I have patients come in and say, well, doctor wasn't very warm, but I didn't care because technically the doctor was really good. And other patients will say, the doctor was really warm, and I don't know about their technical skill, but I really like the fact that they were warm. In a crass way, you're not going to have the doctor become your friend. You're going for the doctor to help you have a child. On the other hand, it sure helps if they are warm and understanding and are empathic.
Yeah. I mean, that was the big thing with the doctor that we used at. He was cautiously hopeful because he understood that anybody going through infertility, like you have that thin wire of, I don't want to hope too much, and right. then devastation, right? It's like that balance beam and stuff. And it's a hard balance, you know, because a lot of times people get so hopeful and then they get so wound up and then it
doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
No, yeah. I think that's exactly right. So, you know, the data from SART is useful. It's useful for understanding probabilities. It may be useful for looking at clinic success rates. You know, I mean, if the clinic down the street's got a 60% success rate with your type of problem and the other clinic has a 20% success rate with exactly the same stuff and comparable numbers, you know, if the data, if you can compare it reasonably, and not every, well, most of us are not statistical geniuses because we don't study it. You know, then maybe you're talking about something that's worth taking a look at. But for the most part, I think this is more about what are the probabilities that I'm going to be successful. You look at the national data, look at the clinic specific data, but the clinic specific data is really useful to the clinics for improving their quality of care.
Yeah. And another factor in choosing for a lot of couples, especially in states that do not have mandated coverage.
Yes.
It's cost.
Without a doubt.
I know people that have gone and that have lived in Wisconsin, they've gone to Colorado because like that's what they could afford. You know, they found a clinic, they were, you know, they've been to Colorado and they were comfortable with it. Us, we went to Missouri. It was cheaper than what it was to be in Wisconsin. And for us, the two clinics we had didn't have good experience. So we went to, you know, Missouri, but.
Well, that's something I think you raised a very important point, which is cost is a very critical factor for many people. This is not cheap stuff. And if you're not in a state where insurance coverage is mandated, you're bearing a huge cost. And you want to be successful because you're bearing a huge cost.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different factors when it comes to choosing your clinic where, I mean, yes, success rates, you know, like important, you know, like to have that understanding. But unless you have like your degree in statistics, you know, really ciphering through that data, you have to take the data, but also like, how does the clinic run their operation?
Yep.
And then how are they treating you? You know, like what is the cost? And I mean, there's so many other different factors than solely choosing it, the clinic off of success rate.
Correct. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. So Bill, I really appreciate your time and I'm glad that you came on because I wanted to clarify that question because.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. You know, I just ended a 12-year stint working with SART, first as mental health rep and then working with electronic communications and branding. And I have over the years met some very intelligent and incredibly committed people through my years working with SART and find it to be a wonderful organization. In addition to collecting the data and providing it, the emphasis on research and improving quality of care is really impressive. And I believe very strongly in the organization. So glad we're able to talk about it and make the information available to a wider range of folks. And I want to thank you for having me on. I think what you're doing with this podcast is great. And it's always a pleasure to talk with you as well as talk about this kind of material.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. I could talk all day about this. So
both of us, we'll be in trouble if we do that.
Oh yeah, for sure. That would be a long episode. Like I said, Bill, appreciate it. And thank you for being here.
Sure. Steve, have a warmer day.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for listening to the Miles Podcast. Miles Podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com. And I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.